So this case is 5-23-1154, Murray et al. Versus Abraham. I have Mr. Ryan in court. Is it, if I mispronounce your name, I'm sorry. Is it Ms. Weichel?
Weichel,
okay. Ms. Weichel sent in a motion yesterday afternoon asking that she be allowed to appear via Zoom. I guess I should read names on the briefs. I didn't realize you were in Will County. So that was granted. I think the clerk contacted Mr. Ryan, gave him the option. He decided to be with us today. We think we have the Zoom. We were having issues with it, but we think we've got those taken care of. If for some reason, Ms. Weichel, you're unable to hear, unable to do anything, just raise your hand. We'll stop. We'll accommodate and make sure everybody has their full time and full day in court today. And what I'm going to do, because I just, again, want to make sure, once you, as you introduce yourself, Mr. Ryan, I want to make sure opposing counsel can hear you okay.
Okay, good morning, Your Honors. I'm Eric Ryan. I represent the appellant. Can you hear me, Cheryl?
Yes, I can. Thank you.
Okay.
Perfect. Thank you all.
And it's an honor to appear in this historic room. The defendant raises three arguments on appeal of these verdicts. The verdicts were $125,000 compensatory damages per tenant and $200,000 per tenant in punitive damages. Our first argument is that the punitive awards of $200,000 each violate 735 ILCS section 5/2-1115.05A and 5/2-1115.2 because no economic damages were proven.
Mr. Ryan, how does Illinois statutory law apply to the Fair Housing Act?
Well, Judge, in their brief, they said themselves, the plaintiffs did, that the Illinois procedural law controls. Well, they could have gone with federal law, but they went with our courts.
Your procedural law and substantive law are different. Are you saying that's a procedural law as to how much damage can be awarded?
The plaintiff regarded that as procedural law.
Well, we're not bound by any misapplications of law. The Fair Housing Act has a damages provision in it.
Yes, and we have an argument that the federal courts in the Seventh Circuit in the Scarmino case said that when a high compensatory award is awarded, that and that was $582,000 in that case, that the punitive award should not have anything other than a one-to-one relationship.
And that was brought pursuant to the Illinois Consumer Fraud Act.
Yes.
Not the Fair Housing Act.
Well, they dismissed.
The Fair Housing Act is a federal statute that has a damages provision in it. So no. Why aren't we there?
Judge, these plaintiffs they dismissed their Consumer Fraud Act count three. So we're only here on the Fair Housing Act.
Right.
And I think that the Seventh Circuit case that I'm talking about would apply. Our third argument is the compensatory award for plaintiff Murray ignored his own inconsistent conduct and was based on improper testimony, which the pro se defendant, my client, did object to, and that objection was overruled. So getting back, Your Honor, and it's a choice of law question. There's no doubt about that. And let me talk about that briefly. The plaintiff chose to be subjected to the rules and procedural statutes of an Illinois state court, even though they did file federal cause of actions, which, of course, they can do in state court under the Federal Housing Act. The plaintiffs never argued below, anywhere in the record, that Illinois law on punitive damages limits did not apply. Parenthetically, the only federal limits on punitive damages in this circuit were imposed by Judge St. Eve, who's from Belleville, in the case I talked about, that's a U.S. Bank case, and that's when she ruled that when there's a high compensatory award in general, the punitives should not be five times that, because that's what the facts were in that case.
That case dealt with a totally different statute and dealt with borrower's rights.
True, and abusive conduct by the bank.
Right,
so
that case has nothing to do with the facts in this case.
But, Judge, if you look at the federal law on proportionality between compensatory and punitive damages, that's what that case speaks to. And I'm going to rearrange my argument, Your Honor, to discuss that federal case.
Okay.
One second. So the Seventh Circuit's due process limitation on a punitive damage award was not followed by the trial court, even though the case of Sacamino versus U.S. Bank from 2019 was brought before the court. In that case, the plaintiff, Ms. Sacamino, proved defendant's outrageous financial misconduct towards her, and she had been in bankruptcy, Chapter 13 protection. And, in fact, she had overpaid her mortgage, and the bank kept claiming that she owed them money. So she won $582,000 in compensatory damages in the Northern District, plus a $3 million punitive award when her economic loss was proven to be $12,000. The holding was that five times compensatory damages punitive award violates federal due process, and the court reduced it to the amount of the compensatory damages of a like amount of $582,000, a one-to-one relationship between the compensatories and punitives for a net verdict for her, affirmed on appeal, $1.164 million on behalf of the victim in that case. So if this court does not accept our first claimed error, that Illinois statutes on punitive damages, where you have to have actual damages, which we concede in this case, there was emotional damages to each plaintiff as a result of the defendant's conduct, the trial court found. But they can't get past the second part if Illinois procedural law applies, and that is you only get three times your economic loss, and they didn't prove no economic loss.
I just don't understand how you can insert Illinois procedural law into a federal Fair Housing Act claim, which has its own damage provision.
Because, Your Honor, that was the court that the plaintiff chose. They could have filed in federal court. They chose not to, for whatever reason.
You can't mix statutes just because you want to.
Well,
you can't file an Illinois consumer product claim and then ask for Fair Housing Act damages.
But, Your Honor, they did dismiss before trial or at trial the Illinois Consumer Fraud Act claim.
I know they did, but that's what I'm saying is if they had left the Illinois Consumer Fraud Act claim, you can't mix damages. You would have had separate verdict forms for each. You would have had a federal Fair Housing Act claim with its damage statutory provision, and then you would have had an ICFA claim with its various statutory provisions and the limitation that you talk about may or may not have applied. I don't know the answer to that question. But what you want to do now is you want to use an Illinois statute to limit something that's a federal cause of action. And that doesn't compute in my brain is my problem with that.
Well, Judge, I don't know how this court is going to characterize the three times economic loss to win any punitive damages, whether that's going to be procedural or substantive. I can see it either way.
We have the old case of BMW, which talks about due process and from a U.S. Supreme Court case point of view. So we have some guidance from the U.S. Supreme Court on due process.
That's why in our post-trial motions, Your Honor, we offered Judge Coker the alternative, either dismiss the punitive verdicts based on the Illinois state law, or you have to file the federal law in a federal cause of two federal causes of actions that in general when there's high compensatory damages awarded that the punitives should bear a one-to-one relationship with that.
There is no federal law I'm aware of that says there must be a one-to-one relationship. In the case that you've cited, they considered other factors as to why it should be a one-to-one procedure. but that they did not rule as a matter of law that due process requires a one-to-one ratio, did they?
That's how I read it, Your Honor, given the facts of that case.
Given the facts of that case?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
Judges, our last argument is that Judge Coker erred when he did not, when he gave very high compensatory award to Mr. Murray when there was a lot of evidence of inconsistent conduct. In other words, we're claiming that the court abused its discretion by ignoring his inconsistent conduct and his felony history when he won $125,000 plus punitives. So objectively, even the trial court itself stated on the record in an earlier hearing before the damages trial that he could not understand why the plaintiffs fought to stay in the premises of an abusive landlord. That's in the transcript of the March 1st, 2023 hearing at pages 7 and 12. His exact language was, he said he, quote, could not imagine the plaintiff staying and not leaving the defendant's apartment. Also objectively, the trial court abused its discretion when it ignored these facts about Plaintiff Murray. He had multiple felony convictions affecting his credibility. In fact, his first witness was to call his probation officer. Number two, he allowed, and this was unquestioning the evidence, the defendant herself to visit him in the hospital while he recovered from a heart attack he claimed at trial that was caused by her. There were no special or economic damages ever proven, not a penny's worth. There was no medical records admitted or medical bills admitted. And, of course, there was no expert medical testimony was ever proffered by the plaintiffs. I think that the court should have found that a reasonable plaintiff would have, of course, blocked this abusive landlord when they were sending texts that they found objectionable. And I believe they were reasonable in believing that the texts were objectionable. So I'm not saying, Your Honor, that Your Honors, that this case did not involve outrageous conduct. That would be dishonest. I'm not going to take that position. Instead, Ms. Kias, his girlfriend, Mr. Murray's girlfriend, was asked at C-283 by her attorney, quote, do you believe that if this lawsuit had not been filed that Ms. Abraham would have killed Joseph? The defendant, the only time in the record, who's pro se, Sally Abraham objects. The court overrules the objection, but in fact, the objection had to have been sustained, even a bench trial, because the evidence was unduly prejudicial, calls for speculation, and sought an expert opinion from a lay witness, one that she could not give.
But so I want to go back about the testimony regarding Mr. Murray, felon status, and whatnot you alluded to. I mean, this was all presented to the trial court as the trier of fact, the person who's supposed to look at the credibility of the witnesses. I'm assuming cross-examination was made, so all of this was fleshed out for the trial court to consider in making its ultimate decision.
Well, I can't say there was any effective cross-examination because my client was pro se, but she had the opportunity. And I felt that overall she was treated well by Judge Coker as a pro se litigant in a major case.
Okay. Let me ask you this. In page 4 of your brief, under statutes involved, you cite 735 ILCS 5/2-1115.05A and D. And when I look that statute up, at the end it says that was declared unconstitutional by Best versus Taylor Machine.
So how that? I reread Best from 1997 lately. And
sorry?
I reread that opinion in the Best case, the big case. I mean, Professor Lawrence Tribe represented the plaintiffs in that case to knock out the $500,000 compensatory damages part of the new statute at that time. But I did not see that this section 2-1115.05 was ever declared unconstitutional.
The footnote at the end, when I look it up in our statute book, the footnote at the end says Public Act 89-7, which added this section, was held unconstitutional in its entirety by Illinois Supreme Court in the case of Best versus Taylor Machine.
Thank you.
Your Honor, when I reread Best lately, I did not see that. And if I should have, I apologize for that. That was never argued in the court below by the other side, by the way. that would be my argument, Your Honors.
Thank you. Well, thank you. Before we let you go, Justice Cates, seems you looked at a few things. Do you have any questions?
No, not right now.
No
other
questions.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you. And obviously, given your time for rebuttal. Ms. Weigel, are you ready to proceed?
I am, Your Honor. Thank you. And once again, Your Honor, I do want to thank you very much for the accommodation of allowing me to appear by Zoom. My name is Cheryl Weigel. I represent the plaintiffs at police. Your Honor, what we have today is a fairly typical Fair Housing Act case. And I think Your Honor's questions about Fair Housing Act being a federal statute are well taken. What made this case unusual before the trial court was that, and I was the attorney who represented the plaintiffs before the trial court, was that the defendant opted to represent herself. She represented herself the entire time. And that led to problems. And as the record shows, over and over again, the trial court recommended that Ms. Abraham retain counsel. And over and over again, Ms. Abraham refused. And over again, including right before trial, the court again recommended that Ms. Abraham retain counsel at the pretrial. The court recommended that Ms. Abraham retain counsel. And she said that she didn't need one because in her belief, the case was easy. And she made multiple comments to that effect, both on and off the record. And in fact, the record also reflects some of the emails that she would send to me about how, in her mind, there was nothing going on in this case, so she believed that she was going to win. And so she did not make the record, quite frankly, that counsel would need for this court to reverse. We had a full trial. And counsel concedes only one time did the defendant object. Just once. And so there is nothing in the record that indicates that we did not prove economic damage. That is a factual statement that would need to be proven by something in the record, and that's simply not there.
Well, what actual damages did you prove?
We believe that we proved that actual damages, including emotional distress, including the fact that my client needed to move, including the lost property, that all of that was established at trial, and Ms. Abraham opted not to cross-examine my client on those issues. And as Your Honors are aware, a pro se litigant is held to the same standard as anyone else. And one of the things that we established in our pre-trial memo was that for purposes of the Fair Housing Act, emotional damages are economic damages. That for purposes of the Fair Housing Act, emotional distress is actual damages. And so here is the problem, and this is why we believe that each of the defendant's arguments fails. Number one, there is a huge waiver problem that the defendant needed to interpose objections at the time, and they were not made. There was no objection raised as to economic damages at trial, and what she is doing now is raising it after the fact. Number two, that there was no objection raised to the procedure of the trial. What we were doing is proceeding under a federal substantive law in state court, which we are allowed to do because, as Your Honors are aware, Illinois courts are courts of general jurisdiction. And so what you are not allowed to do is pick and choose which substantive and procedural rules you get to have. But number three, even applying the rules that counsel has stated, none of those are violated. So in order, first of all, we believe that all of these were waived. But even if Your Honors find that they were not, The statute says the three times damages that are awarded, not three times damages that are proven. And counsel concedes that compensatory damages were awarded. So even by counsel's reading of the statute, that statute was not violated here. And so Your Honors don't even have to go any farther than that. On the base of the statute, it says three times the damages awarded. Number two, right after attempting to apply a state substantive law to a federal case, they attempt to apply federal procedural law to a state case and say, well, actually, you have to apply federal procedural law. No, again, that is something that should have been raised before trial when the court held a pretrial and we went over this, and that was not raised. And then finally, we get to the issue of credibility. testimony. And I think what Your Honor said was quite correct. The trial court is in a position to judge the credibility of witnesses. And what we are dealing with now is an attack on the credibility of the plaintiff. And that's for cross-examination. There is a reason that the court below warned Ms. Abraham on multiple occasions against proceeding pro se. There is a reason that Ms. Abraham decided not to obtain an attorney, and this is the result. And so what the defendant is asking for, in essence, is special treatment. She's asking for a do-over because the trial didn't go the way she expected. And we don't believe that the court should indulge that request. Now, I do want to make one other point about this credibility issue. Counsel mentioned that my client's parole officer was one of our witnesses, and that's true. But it kind of undercuts his argument that he is not a credible witness if his own parole officer is coming to testify on his behalf. And it only goes to buttress how the court below made proper determinations of credibility, that this was not something that the court below pulled out of a hat. If Ms. Abraham had a problem with that testimony, she should have objected, raised that, or done proper cross-examination. She chose not to do that, just as she chose not to retain an attorney. And now she should be bound by the results of the trial. That is our argument, and we're happy to take Your Honor's questions.
Justice Cates?
I don't think I have any.
Justice Long?
No questions, thank
you. I don't think we have any questions.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. So, Mr. Ryan, go right ahead with your rebuttal.
Thank you. Briefly, on the waiver argument that Ms. Michael just brought up, and it's in her brief too, when she said that my client represented herself throughout the trial court, that is technically not true because after the verdicts of August of 23 were entered, she hired me and I filed a timely post-trial motion. 2 days later, I filed an amended post-trial motion that the court allowed me to file. And the first post-trial motion, page 1 at C-274, we claim the punitive award was excessive and bore no relationship to the compensatory damages awarded. In the amended post-trial motion, on page 1 at C-288, we made the same argument in the amended post-trial motion. And on the 19th of October of last year, in our memorandum of law before the hearing, in support of our post-trial motions, we cited at C-326, 735, ILCS 5/2, 1115.05, and we cited the Sacramento case, too, at C-329-330. So when the circuit court denied the post-trial motions, it had before it defendants' arguments that the punitive awards were excessive. I don't know that the defendant was required before a judgment verdict was issued in writing, was she required to raise punitive damages arguments at that time that when there was no punitive award entered? In other words, she's not Kreskin. She cannot read the court's mind. And the only time that any lawyer could have objected to the punitive awards would have been on a post-judgment motion.
I think the reference might have been that you would have objected to some of these questions that were asked about emotional distress. Had you been the attorney,
it would have been completely different.
Mr. Ryan, I think
I would have removed the case to federal court.
You would have done things differently. But you would agree that under the Fair Housing Act, emotional distress is an actual damage.
Yes.
And there were multiple questions asked of this. Mm-hmm. Of these tenants about the distress that it had caused.
No doubt. The record is replete with that.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions, Your Honors?
This is all?
No.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Counsel Oxley, we will take this matter under advisement. We will issue an order in due course.